From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, when it comes to the economic challenges facing working-class Americans, there are some overlooked variables.
You know, we've been long focused on income inequality as a country, and we've focused a lot on wealth inequality. But there is this third piece where people have unequal access to steadiness, unequal access to stability.
Later, why a Wisconsin man is harnessing his own enthusiasm and money to help others harness the sun.
People are waiting for somebody else to do it. They're waiting for the power companies. They're waiting for our legislators. I think it's going to have to come from the people at the bottom.
Plus, we'll travel to the Milwaukee House of Correction to learn about an innovative way to equip inmates with skills to thrive when they finish their sentences.
And Rob Schraub talks about his climb from MIAD student to Emmy-winning and Oscar-nominated Hollywood screenwriter and director. Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Welcome to Monday's show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. One of the buzzwords when it comes to the economy is uncertainty. Politicians blame slow economic growth on uncertainty over future tax rates or incoming revenue. Businesses decide to hold off on hiring because of uncertainty.
All of that leads to a lot of uncertainty for people in middle and lower classes of wage earners. Uncertainty over paying the rent, buying food, affording college.
Rachel Schneider wanted to learn how American families are withstanding these economic times. And she and some fellow researchers set out to study families over the course of time to get some data and insight.
The result was their recent book, The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. Schneider, who is co-author of the book, joined us on the line recently. Welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm so glad to do it. Thanks for having me.
So what was lacking in our understanding of how families are getting by in the 21st century that you were trying to learn by setting up this Financial Diaries project?
Well, the main thing is we have so much data in the U.S., but most of it is aggregate numbers or averages or snapshots in time. And so those big picture statistics miss a lot about the day-to-day lived experience of real people. And so we wanted to get underneath those numbers to talk to real people and understand what their perception of their financial life was and understand how their finances evolved over a year.
It's interesting. So often we hear about, you know, wanting to add data to anecdotal evidence. In some ways, it sounds like you wanted to add anecdotal evidence to data.
We did. We did, although it's more than anecdotal evidence, because we gathered financial data from 235 families for a full year, right? Every dollar that came in and out of their house. So it's both the anecdotal, it's the understanding the person, but it's also the seeing how money moves through time through a family's life rather than getting that snapshot of how much they have in their wallet today.
Well, why was it so important to do it in that way? I mean, give us a sense of your methodology and the kinds of families that you included.
Sure. So we had families in four different locations in the U.S. They were in Mississippi, California, along the Ohio-Kentucky border, and New York. And they really varied a lot, right? If you just think about those locations, their experiences were so different. In New York, it was urban, really densely populated areas, right? Whereas in Mississippi, you're working with a rural population. California, we were more in the suburbs. And so some of it was about like understanding the different versions of an American life. What all of the families had in common was that they had somebody in the household who was working, and they were all within the income range of between the poverty level and, let's call it, like roughly around area median income, sort of a middle class, roughly a middle class income. So they were all lower middle class working households. And what we did is we had 10 field researchers who were in each of the locations, and they went and met with families in person. And so we call it the financial diaries, but it's not really that we gave people diaries to fill out. It's that a person went and met with them and gathered data from them. And that gave us this really amazing opportunity to ask lots of why questions, right? Like, why are you managing your financial life this way? Or why was there a huge income spike last month? Or, you know, how are you thinking about this particular thing? And that that was really powerful. And because we were doing it for a year, we were able to develop real trust with the families who stuck it out. This was a big investment for them. And so for the most part, they were sticking it out because they wanted to share their story and they wanted to have this ongoing relationship with the field researcher. And that's really the power of it. That's what allows us to get below the, you know, underneath the aggregate numbers we usually understand our economy through.
You mentioned the concept of the income spike, and that's, you know, one of the trends that repeats itself throughout the book is this idea of income volatility. And I think maybe a lot of us in the media or maybe throughout society have this image of the different levels of income, but maybe a general thought that people's paychecks look the same from month to month. But you're right, that's very much not the case for many people.
No, it's really not. And one of the most memorable moments for me of the study was early on when we were just formulating the research plan and figuring out where to do the research and how it worked. And so we were having really broad conversations with families. And I sat in a room with one family, and we didn't even end up writing about this in the book, but this is just a moment that stuck with me. And I said, you know, what's going on with your financial life? And this woman said, and she worked at the checkout counter at the grocery store, and her husband had a job in a warehouse. And she said, basically, you know, it's all about Sunday nights. On Sunday nights, we sit down. By then, we've each gotten our schedule for the week. We know how many hours we're going to be given to work. But they both had full-time jobs. But in a lot of places of employment now, even if you have a full-time job, the number of hours you get each week flexes up and down. So over half of Americans work hourly jobs. So she said, you know, I know if I've gotten 33 hours or 28, or at 40 or 42. My husband knows the same. And they sit down and they estimate what their paychecks will bring them. And then they pull out all their bills and they estimate which bills they can pay with that money. You know, hearing that really changes how you think about budgeting. We want to think people can set a budget, set a monthly expenditure expectation, and then stick to it. And the whole only thing you've got to do is help people develop discipline to stick to their goals. But the reality is a lot more complicated for people. The math is more complicated. The variation introduces all kinds of opportunities for mishap. And that's really what we saw throughout our sample, was that people had very big swings between their high paychecks and their low paychecks. And while some of that was seasonable and predictable, that didn't mean it was always manageable.
Right. You write about one of the people that stuck with me is the woman in Mississippi who works as a dealer at a casino, and she relies a lot on tips. And it's interesting that it fluctuates from year to year based on what the college football schedule is like there.
I know. I never would have thought to ask that, frankly, because I'm not a football person, right? I mean, it's just outside of my scope of experience in a way. But yeah, she works as this is Janice, and she's in Mississippi dealing blackjack. And you know, she likes a lot about the job. It's got reasonable benefits. It's been a decent job for her. But yeah, when football games are played away, there's less traffic into the casino, or when they and so the college football schedule really affects her earnings.
She's an African-American woman, and I think you're right that that race and other demographics are also wrapped up in the income volatility equation.
They are. So, you know, lower income, lower wage jobs are more likely to also be volatile, and lower income, lower wage jobs are also disproportionately held by people of color, and also disproportionately by women. So a lot of what we're seeing, the effects of it aren't equally distributed across our society. And it led us to think a lot about the idea of inequality. You know, we've been long focused on income inequality as a country, and increasingly so lately. We've focused a lot on wealth inequality. But there is this third piece where people have unequal access to steadiness, unequal access to stability. And stability is a distinct and separate goal for people. Aside from having enough income, people also want to have a stable financial life. And you can help people get that by giving them more money. But even at lower income levels, stability matters.
you know, we mentioned this outdated idea that paychecks are always the same from month to month. As you got into learning how people live, what were some of the other outdated mentalities, at least in some cases, that you find have an impact on how people earn and live?
Probably the biggest thing is the conventional wisdom about how a financial life evolves over the life cycle. So the image we all have in our head, and that was really true for a lot of people in the 50s and 60s, although, to be clear, not true for everyone, was this idea of a life cycle arc. You can even picture this upward trending curve where you would, you know, get an education, go get a job, gradually make more money as you get promoted and have more seniority and have more responsibility, and you gradually earn more. And then, you know, somewhere in that cycle, you'd get married or have kids, you'd start investing for their education, you'd put money away from retirement, and then at the end, you'd retire and you'd earn less money, so the curve would slope down, but you'd have put away enough or invested in a house that rose in value, and so you'd be able to have a secure retirement. And this idea of the life cycle arc is a really important idea in personal finance, a really important idea in how we allocate tax subsidies, right? So we spend $400 billion a year helping people to save for later, because we expect them to live on that arc. Yet what we saw is that a lot of people, they're not living on an upward trending smooth curve. They're living on a constantly up and down but flat line, where they're not going to earn a lot more 10 years from now than they earn today. And in the meantime, they have such big swings in their month-to-month income that they're not really thinking as much about how to save for retirement or for buying a house as they are thinking about how to save for 3 months from now when my income's going to dip seasonally, or how to put aside enough money so that if my car breaks down in 6 months, I can pay for it. And so a lot of what we came away from this work thinking about is how important sort of near-term financial planning is and how lacking our society really is in providing the help people need for those nearer term objectives. So, right, that $400 billion we spend on subsidies for savings, that's all for retirement, homeownership, and education. We don't spend any money in tax subsidies to help people save for emergencies or for the natural ups and downs in their financial life. And similarly, we haven't innovated the financial products that would help people to accomplish those goals as much as we have thought about like portfolio diversification. It opens up some new thinking about solutions.
Right. And you're right that there are some people out there that have created some tools that can kind of, you know, smooth the playing field for them, if you will, help people go, you know, survive the peaks and valleys.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of it is about employer practices, right? So you're seeing some innovation around like giving workers more control over their own schedules or more guarantees of predictability. And some of that has to come from policy change too. But there is also some hope in the development of financial services or tweaks to existing financial services that make it easier for people to manage the volatility that they're experiencing. So we write, for example, about one company called Even, which is a pretty new company. And what they do is they try and smooth out those ups and downs in people's paychecks. And they when you sign up with them, they start monitoring your paychecks and they calculate what your average paycheck is. And then when it's low, they boost you up to average. And when it's high, they pay back that boost. And when it's high, they ask, do you want to save extra of this high paycheck? And that service, that idea of, like, how do we help you smooth it out, is a very different frame than saying, how do we lend you money or how do we help you save? They're really trying to sell the concept of stability.
Well, and I wonder if for the families that were involved in this project, there's a certain comfort in knowing that they're not alone here.
Definitely. Yeah. You know, I think that's true for everyone. Like, financial problems bring so much shame. And we heard this from families as they described when they had trouble, right? People don't talk about their financial problems. They don't talk about having had to declare bankruptcy or getting being unable to pay their credit card debt or not knowing how they'll make their car payment. All of those moments bring shame and anxiety. And I do think we need to change that as a society. We need to be able to talk about financial problems so that people understand they're not alone. It's not all their fault. They're doing the best they can amidst flawed circumstances. And if they feel less shame, they can reach out for help in different ways.
Well, Rachel Schneider, it's important work. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the chance to talk about it.
Rachel Schneider is Senior Vice President at the Center for Financial Services Innovation. She's the co-author with Jonathan Mordick of The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty.
Our interview first aired in July. Schneider will lead an expert panel on economic uncertainty this Wednesday at Community Advocates in Milwaukee. There is a link to more information from WUWM.com.
Coming up next on the show, why a Wisconsin man is taking it upon himself to help equip mission-driven groups with solar power. Lake Effect continues with that story in a moment on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tye.
And I'm Bonnie North. By the end of this year, more than 3,000 solar projects will dot the Wisconsin landscape, from utility-owned systems to home rooftops. That might sound like quite a lot of solar, but altogether, they create enough energy to power just 11,500 households.
But a growing number of people want to boost that number. Cal Cuyer is putting his money where his solar passion is. The Edgerton-based business owner recently created a fund called Solar for Good. It provides grants to mission-based Wisconsin nonprofits, such as churches, to switch them to a higher power, that is, solar. The advocacy group Renew Wisconsin is administering the initiative.
Lake Effect Susan Bent spoke with Cuyer at his factory where he produces aluminum idle rollers. The design engineer says the Solar for Good idea struck him about the time he decided to install solar panels on his own company's rooftop.
My system will produce probably about, 280,000 to 300,000 kilowatt hours of electricity per year, and I would estimate that I use about 240,000 kilowatt hours. So we will actually produce more electricity than I use, but a lot of that electricity is produced when we're not here, so it gets sold back to the utility.
So I had in my head this scenario. You have kids, and they said, "Dad, you've got to do this solar thing," but not at all.
I've been always interested in the solar from the green perspective of the environmental versus the money part. But what I found in my life is that things usually don't happen and they don't go mainstream until things make sense monetarily. And I guess I was always very interested in it because I do have two daughters and I have a granddaughter now. And my perception is that we could and should do more to leave our children with a better future. And I firmly believe that solar-generated electricity is the way to do it, and we got to get off fossil fuels. So my kids aren't bugging me to do this. I'm probably bugging my kids to do it and trying to bug everybody else to do it.
So that brings us to Solar for Good. You decided to put some of your money where your mouth is and try to encourage more solar. How does that work?
Well, I had gone to a seminar in Madison. It was about putting your money into something that can make you happy, and I thought about it a little bit, and I said, I really want to stop the burning of fossil fuels if I can. And I thought, what if I really make a big effort to do that? What if I get as many solar photovoltaic systems installed as I possibly can from now until the end of my time? Then I can really say that I did something, and I can be happy at the time. So I was like, I can spend my money getting a new Mercedes-Benz, or I can spend my money getting solar collectors installed on nonprofits. The idea behind that was that if we can install on, you know, churches and other nonprofits, then all the people that are going there will also see this as happening. So I want to spread the message that solar is not just green for the environment, it's green monetarily. You could actually save money by doing it. It can pay for itself. And I want to get that word out because I don't think a lot of people know it.
So then you connected with Renew Wisconsin, an advocacy group, to administer this grant program.
Well, I was going to try to do something like set up a nonprofit to administer it and then do it myself. But, you know, I'm running a business, and that does take a lot of time. And I realized at some point that, boy, that would be really tough to run a nonprofit and then try to run a company at the same time. And I was talking to Tyler,
the executive director of Renew Wisconsin.
Yes. And he said, well, maybe this is something that we could administer. And I said, well, that would be, I guess, much better from my perspective in that you guys are very well linked in the Wisconsin community. And then I feel like they're doing a very good job of working and trying to get, you know, there's a lot of laws and things like that that are skewed more in the favor of fossil fuel burning, in my mind, than in solar. And so they're working very hard to change some of those rulings and work with the Public Service Commission and things like that. But I said, you know, I want to see systems installed. That's the way to truly get this done, not talk about it, but actually do it. That's what led to going this route.
So you've pledged $125,000 to kick off this program. Is that right?
Yes.
If it really starts humming, because as you've said very clearly, you want to see installations out there. That could become an annual budget?
That's my plan right now. You know, I can't guarantee it forever, but I'm hoping that I can continue to do that and stay at that level. I would also like to see if maybe other people might want to do this as well, because I feel there's this cascading effect. Once you reach all these parishioners and all these people that are in these groups, I want to magnify that effect. And, you know, it's harder to install for an individual homeowner to do something, and obviously you can't give money to a homeowner and say, hey, install the system. You can only really give money to nonprofits. I don't want to say it's illegal to give money to somebody else, but there's limits on where you can give money.
The fact that you and your wife are making this contribution and intend on keeping it up is a model that maybe a lot of people wouldn't even think about.
Well, again, you know, that foundation dinner they went to, that really kind of made me think a little bit about it. And I was kind of all along saying, hey, we've got to stop the burning of fossil fuels. It just kind of hit me. It was the right time for me to hear that message. And it was like, hey, you know, you could talk about not burning fossil fuels, but if you don't really do anything, then what are you complaining about? You're not doing anything. So for me, I think that's the key here, is that we all have to do this. I think people are waiting for somebody else to do it. They're waiting for the power companies to do it. They're waiting for our legislators to do it. They're waiting for somebody else to get it done. And I just don't think that's going to happen. I think it's going to have to come from the people at the bottom, because there's a lot of money burning fossil fuels, and the people that are in power do not want to stop doing that. I mean, there's just a huge amount of money against solar, even though financially it makes sense. There's a lot of power out there right now trying to block it as much as they possibly can. Public utilities, they have monopoly power that was granted in 1900. They control pricing, and they control what you pay for the electricity, and they control what they buy it back from you. And you don't have any other options other than buying from them and selling to them. Like, I'm in Alliant Energy territory. My only choice is them for a power company. I can't buy from anybody else. And I can't sell my electricity to anybody else. And I can give you an example of what has happened since I put it in. I was paying about 12 cents per kilowatt hour before I put the solar system in. And I don't know if you're familiar with demand pricing. They price businesses different than residential. But anyway, the gist of it is, after I put my solar system in, I've averaged paying to them about 18 cents per kilowatt hour on anything that I buy from Alliant Energy. Anything that I sell to Alliant has averaged 3 cents per kilowatt hour. So that's what I'm talking about when I'm saying there's a lot of power trying to block solar. Actually, if the power companies didn't have the monopoly power they have, I would say you could probably pay for a solar system in 5 years. But because of the predatory pricing model that electric utilities have, it actually takes 10 years to pay for it. Still worth it to do it, but I'm just saying they take the value out because they set the policy.
But as you said earlier, your view on this is it just needs to be done. People need to step forward. Is
yeah,
that how you feel?
I just feel like we have to. I mean, I firmly believe that we do have a problem burning fossil fuels, and I really don't like the thought of what that's doing to my children and my grandchildren. I feel like I'm giving them a bad deal, and I'm not going to bury my head in the sand and say that we're not involved in these changes that are occurring. And this is a great little planet that we live on, and I don't think we should be doing what we're doing.
Cal Cuyer, along with his wife Lori, founded and are funding Solar for Good. 10 nonprofits have applied for the first round of grants. Another round of grants will be awarded next spring. You can find more information at WUWM.com.
A quick break now, and then we'll travel to the Milwaukee House of Correction to visit a program that works to equip women inmates with some coping tools for when they get out of jail. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. At the heart of our prison system is the term corrections, the idea that a jail term can be used to correct the behavior that put someone behind bars in the first place.
There have been plenty of debates about whether prison is about punishment or rehabilitation, but people on both sides of the debate could probably agree that it would be great if people left prison with some tools to succeed back in the community.
That's one of the aims behind a partnership between a local nonprofit and a local jail. Lake Effect Mayan Silver takes us there.
Behind the locked doors of the House of Correction, for an hour every month, an unlikely message emanates.
Again, allow the morning light that enters this room to touch your face and to allow yourself to receive it, is to remember your way home, to your worth, to yourself.
That's Ali Sarzinski, teaching one of two yoga group classes for women inmates. If it weren't for the bunk bed frames in the background and the blue jumpsuits of the program participants, for a brief time you'd forget that you're in a jail. But a jail is exactly where we are. I met Katie Connell Lynch, associate director of the Benedict Center's Women's Reentry Program, which runs the yoga classes, at the entrance of the jail.
This area that we're going into is women's only, the women's only dorm, so it's secluded from male inmates.
These women at the HOC are locked away from society for reasons ranging from unpaid tickets to felonies. But the Benedict Center's programming is meant to help them readjust to society upon release. And a lot of that has to do with addressing one thing.
We know that 77 to 98% of women who are currently incarcerated have experienced some form of trauma in their lives. And from my work with justice-involved women, it tends to be complex trauma. So that means it's not just a single traumatic event that they've experienced, it's repeated traumatic experiences that they've been through in their lives.
In this layout, we have the women in a circular format versus in a lot of classes, you're gonna see mats and rows. And that's because we don't want anybody to be behind somebody else so that there's this awareness that there's a wall behind them and also a capacity to see everybody else in the room.
That's yoga instructor Allie explaining that the class is trauma sensitive in a way different than classes in the community.
For example, if I'm bringing a student into a posture, a lot of times I'll name how long we're going to be there and we'll count the breaths together. Or there's more of an emphasis on what is the sensation that you're experiencing in your body? And as a result of that connection, you get to choose the shape that you want to create within that or the modification that you want to take or if you want to skip the posture altogether. So there's always this room for students to decide whether or not they want to choose to take the pose or in what variation they want to take the pose.
It turns out that yoga was a hot ticket for the approximately 120 women in the HOC dorms. In a survey of options, they chose it as the number one activity they wanted the Benedict Center to provide, even though many of them had never done it before.
We're seeing the rise in popularity of yoga in the mainstream, so I think that might be part of the interest. And I think maybe just a sense of curiosity, too. My guess is they heard that it was good for them at some point and went, cool, I want to try that.
As the women enter the class, they approach the circle of colorful mats draped in a natural light that contrasts with the artificial light everywhere else in the gym.
Good morning. Welcome to yoga. How are we doing?
Great.
Great. Doing all right?
After intros, Allie starts with the first exercise.
You're going to check in to see how your body's feeling, how your mind's feeling, how your heart's feeling. And after you check in with that, you're going to use one word and or one to a few words to name how you're feeling. So we'll go in a circle.
My mind feels frustrated. My heart is sad. My body is somewhat tense.
Not all the women have such a somber start, but everyone seems to flow naturally through the hour of poses to the final relaxation. After the class, I spoke with a woman who wanted to be known as Janice. She said she was in custody because she could not afford to pay restitution on one of her cases. These in-custody classes are her first time doing yoga, and she's a fan.
Spiritually, I think it helps out because it's got, you clear your mind, you clear all your thoughts, and like a little square box, you put all the good things inside the box and all the bad things stay outside the box.
Janice said that she had some immediate things to be kept outside of the box that day. Specifically, someone swapping her for her canteen treats a few days ago and not giving her the canteen as promised today. She says yoga helped her get over that.
Yes, it did, because when I came in, I was feeling real uptight, hard, cold-hearted. And after I got there and did all the breathing exercise, it kind of stimulated my mind to say, don't even think about it. Stay focused on what you focused in on. Don't let that upset you and ruin the day for you. Keep your smile on your face today and let it be known to the people there that it's not no problem to me. I took it like it was and I left it like that. And that's where it's going to stay, right there.
She thinks that yoga is a tool that more people in custody could use.
Because there's a lot of things that's bottled up in people's mind because they don't know about their cases. They have a stressed out problem. But if they have to go to the yoga classes, a lot of that stress will be relieved, you know.
Sundar Dodi has a nursing background. And because of her depression that fuels alcohol use, she's in custody for her fourth OWI. Like Janice, this is the first time that she's had access to yoga. And this is her fourth class with Allie. She hopes yoga will help her stay sober, but there's more in it for her.
When you're in a jail setting, you have no control over anything, sleep, eat, anything. So being able to control your depth of how you can bend over or how much you can stretch, just kind of giving yourself back that power that you're a person, not just an inmate or a number.
Allie says that's what she's been going for all along.
That's like the biggest inspiration that I have here is to just remind the women of like, the ownership of their bodies, and at least a little taste of freedom.
For Janice, the yoga does just that. But her other big takeaway is that someone cares enough to volunteer.
If they can do it and bring themselves in here and do that and take time out with us women to get us right back on the right track, I sure will be joining all the classes they have. And when I get out, I'm going to continue to go to the classes. So a lot of communities kind of, people don't care no more. It's got to be somebody in the neighborhood that cares enough to say, well, we're going to do this here, and we're going to uplift this neighborhood, and we're going to stand out and step up and do something about it. A lot of people ain't doing nothing about it. You just sit back and do nothing until the worst come. And then people need to get together and do things about it before the worst come.
For Lake Effect, I'm Mayan Silver.
You can see pictures of the yoga program at the House of Correction and read more at WUWM.com.
One more break, and then Wisconsin native Rob Schraub's journey from Mayfield, Wisconsin to Hollywood via MIAD. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Rob Schraub wasn't a Hollywood insider when he started his career in the industry, but the Emmy-winning and Oscar-nominated writer and director quickly became a go-to guy for good work. Monster House, Parks and Recreation, and the Sarah Silverman Program are a few of the films or shows he's had a hand in shaping.
The Mayfield, Wisconsin native says a lot of the credit goes to the work ethic he learned as an illustration student at the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design. And it's to his alma mater he returns this week to work with students and give a public talk called Embracing the dumb. The Rob Schraub Experience.
I interrupted him at his home in Los Angeles as he was working on a new script to talk with him about his career. Rob, it is a pleasure to virtually meet you. Rob Schraub, it is such a pleasure to virtually meet you.
Aha. Yes. Good to be here this morning, Bonnie.
Well, I want to take you back a little ways here in Milwaukee to start out. About 1990 or 91, and The Dead Alewives.
Oh, my God. Yes. My sketch group that I did when I was working with Dick Chudnow for Comedy Sports, independent of Comedy Sports, we did like a couple of buddies of mine that I met during stand-up and doing improv. We decided to start doing these sketch nights, which were, whereas Comedy Sports is more of a family show, this was a little bit more risque, edgier. So we got like the college crowd during the summers, and it was a blast. It was really fun.
Well, the reason I know about this, because I'm not from here, one of my colleagues here remembers going on a school night. She said it was Wednesday nights late.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And she said it was one of the funniest things to date that she has ever experienced.
It was fun. Doing improv back then, it was rebellious, it was wild, it was crazy, there was no wrong answers. We were just starting out. And that's the thing that's amazing when you're just starting out with anything, is that you don't know how to do it wrong yet. And we were doing, believe me, we were doing a lot of things wrong, but we were just having a good time. And it was really fun. The audiences were into it. And yeah, it was where I learned comedy and storytelling.
Talk about the idea of wrong. I mean, so many times in creative pursuits, we're told there is nothing that's wrong. But you're saying very much differently, that there are things that are wrong.
Well, I mean, wrong in quotes. I mean, I agree. There shouldn't be anything wrong. But when you get into, when you start doing like anything artistic as a business, you start seeing things that quote-unquote work and quote-unquote don't work, and you're encouraged to do the stuff that does work. But that stuff starts feeling familiar and not as interesting, and it isn't until somebody does it wrong again that people start going, well, maybe this is the new way of doing it. I think it ebbs and flows with the taste of your audience. You know, I look back at some of the stuff that we were doing early in the days, and I roll my eyes going, oh, gosh, that's embarrassing. But the passion of just attacking something without fear, I do miss. You know, it's just, there's like, hey, you know, I'm just here to have a good time. There was such a purity to it. Unfortunately, as you get older and you do these things more and more and the stakes get higher and higher, you tend to play things a little safer, which is unfortunate. You know, I mean, it's human nature. You know, you do what works and you try to avoid things that don't work. So it's only human nature to go, let's keep going with the path of least resistance, because it's painful, you know, doing what we do, you know, whether it's like art or comedy or TV, movies or anything like that. It's difficult. You're trying to create something that's never existed before and feels fresh and new. But if you go too far in one way, you turn people off and they're like, this is too crazy, this is too wild. But, you know, that when you get into that pattern, and you start doing things that, you know, quote unquote work, and there's like, this is the right way to do it, it can get stale. So it's good even when you find like a path that works, to not lose that gutsy, that rebellious, that I've never tried this before. Who cares? There's no wrong answers. Let's just do it. It's something that you fight with every single day. I fight with it all the time. As a writer, you know, I'm working on a script right now, and I'll like spend all day on like the first paragraph rewriting it, because you'll write it and you go, oh, that sounds too expensive, or this joke doesn't work, or this is like, blah, blah, blah. Whereas when I was just starting out, I could be like, oh, I just finished a script in a week. What's so hard about this? It's because I didn't know what was wrong when I just
yeah
miss those days.
Well, and also you didn't have people depending on you. There weren't budgets and, you know, finance committees and all of that. And, you know, we talk about that kind
of deadlines
and that kind of creativity. But people are depending on you for their paycheck.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's especially when you're, you know, like a showrunner of a TV show or a director or a producer. Yeah, there's people that are waiting on the script. And you, especially in TV, because it's like a week-to-week thing and there's a schedule because you can't just like go, oh, we didn't make it this week, so there's no new episode of television. That's just an unheard of. You did that, you would never work again. So you get a script done and then you hand it off to your, you know, your line producer who breaks down like the budget, and then you hand it over to like the props people and the director's assistant and the DP, and you start scheduling like, okay, how many sets are we going to build? And then how many location shoots? Can we do any location shoots? Is it that type of show? Can we afford to do all this? And nothing can get started until somebody finishes that script, that document. And, you know, it's hard because you want to be a perfectionist about this, but eventually you just have to let it go. And that's frustrating. That's a frustrating thing, especially in TV, because it's like you find yourself feeling like, oh, I'm shooting the schedule, not trying to make quality work, you know. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, with all these obstacles and all these schedules and all these impossible hurdles that you have to jump over, there's still good work that comes out. That's the exciting thing about all of this, is just like this system is programmed to make you fail and make work be mediocre, but there's still quality that comes out. And that's just like the exciting thing about like human ingenuity, is like we find a way, you know, no matter how many walls are in front of us, there's always a crack, there's always a hole, there's always a way to think around, to think outside of the box and do something different that isn't going to intimidate the audience. It's going to feel like, oh yeah, oh, I've been wanting to see something like this my whole life. How come they never do stuff like this?
Right, and I didn't even know I wanted to see it.
Yes, that's it. That's the thing, is trying to find that scientific, mathematical, you know, spiritual, I don't know, telekinetic almost, like, equation where you connect with, like, the masses and have them go, yeah, this thing speaks to just me, even though it speaks to, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of people sometimes. So that's what I find so fascinating and wonderful about it. But also, at the same time, I find it so painful. It is a painful, painful business. It is a painful thing, but I wouldn't trade it for the world.
Do you ever find yourself, maybe not literally hearkening back to the dead alewives portion of your life, but I mean, do you tap into that rebellion, that kind of willingness to just throw it all out there and say, hey, here it is? Does that find its way into your work now?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. It's some of my more fringe stuff that I would do, like on a podcast, like, say, Harmontown or social media, like Instagram or Facebook or Twitter or something like that, or some of my live shows that I do here where I cut clips together from bad movies and things and comment on them. That part of me will always exist because I enjoy it too much. That's my free time. That's my free time fun. But when it gets into, like, say, doing a show like Ghosted, or writing a feature script or something like that, it depends on who you're working with. Some people want that side of you and others don't. And, you know, I would lie if I would say a little bit doesn't trickle in. But you got to know your audience. You got to know what you've signed up for. And it is a business at the end of the day. You're not doing it for yourself. You're doing it for your clients, which is a network or a studio or an actor or whoever. You know, you have to kind of go, what am I being asked to do? There's so many different parts of an artist. You know, there's the fun, rebellious, whatever, let's just do it, and who cares? It's not the end result, it's not the money, it's not the audience, it's just let's do something. And then there's the other side of the spectrum where it's like, I was hired to do X, Y, and Z, and that's what I'm going to do, and I'm going to turn off my rebellious side and just give the people what they want, because at the end of the day, that's the job I signed up for. That's my accountability. That's my responsibility.
It seems like the options today, though, to incorporate all of those different parts of you as an artist, there's just more opportunity, whether it's a podcast, a live show,
yeah.
You're working, you know, you've got fingers in lots of different things that feed you in different ways.
It's a great time, because back like 20 years ago, maybe even 15 years ago, there was just no way to get to the people unless you had like the backing of a network or a studio or a newspaper or a magazine or your own publishing company, like I did with my comic book. You know, there was no way to do it. Now, all I have to do is type something and get Twitter followers or Instagram or YouTube or whatever. You can get an audience, and it's all based on what you got to show. You know, you will find an audience. People have fans now, you know, like just average everyday people have like a fan base, and it's a great time. You know, it's like overloading sometimes, like, wow, you know, I could really do it. There's nothing stopping me. I have a movie studio in my phone right now. Plus, if I press a button, it will go to 5 different social media platforms and it'll be seen, you know. And you go, well, do I do this for myself? Do I do this for them? I'm not going to make any money off of it, but maybe I would lead to something. It is an exciting time. It's a great time for somebody who wants to get their work out there.
Do you think growing up here in the Midwest, in Wisconsin specifically, going to MyAd, you know, kind of cutting your teeth here at comedy clubs, do you think you've tapped into some sort of zeitgeist that's different from somebody from the coasts?
Well, I would say if you're born here, my wife is born here, and she, you know, lived here and she was surrounded by it. And so she has a different experience than I did. When I was growing up in Mayville, Wisconsin, and then eventually went to school at MyAd in Milwaukee, coming out here just seemed like such an impossibility. It's like, it's just like, what? No, you have to be really, really amazing to go out there. You know, you have to be, am I good enough? Traveling across the country to the land of the unknown and not knowing everybody, it's a big, risky step. And once you're out here, you really got to jump into it and work and be prepared. When you're born here, you're kind of just like, oh, you know, when I graduate, I'll probably whatever. And I know these people, I'm already connected. When I moved out here in 97, I had my comic book that was optioned to be made into a film. And I used that as kind of like the cornerstone of everything that I did afterwards. You know, I had my foot in the door. But I also went with the attitude of like, no, I'm here serious. I need to get something going, and I need to do something. This is something I've been dreaming about my whole life. Now's the time to start doing it. And I just jumped right in. And luckily, you know, things just kind of happened right away. And I think it's just that attitude, the work ethic that you learn at MyAd, which is the best thing that I learned from working at the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design, is the work ethic of just like having like a deadline, finishing it, getting it done, being surrounded by other creative people. And the community, it all pushes you. Again, I was lucky enough to start working right away because I had the comic book. That was like my fallback. I was still publishing it at the time. Plus, it was being optioned to be made into a movie, and we had some other things. And so we were on a roll of sorts. When we came out here and the book was optioned to be made into a movie, we wanted to write the script. When I say we, I mean my partner, Dan Harmon, who came out here with me, who was a part of the Dead Alewives. We wanted to write my comic book movie, but we were told, oh, comic book people don't write movies, screenwriters do. And we were like, well, how do you do that? And they said, well, you got to have to write a spec script, which is like write a script for free and see how if anybody likes what you do. So that's what we did, and we wrote this script, and it got shown around, and it got into the right hands. It got into the hands of Robert Zemeckis, and we met with him, and we pitched him Monster House, and that was the beginning of everything. You know, we started back, you know, in 98, and it was like less than 2 years we were working with Robert Zemeckis. And I think it was just kind of like that, not knowing how to do it wrong. You know, I mean, like, when we said, oh, well, okay, well, we'll be screenwriters now because that's what we want to do. There was a lot of people rolling their eyes, like going, it's not that easy. And they're like, well, let's give it a shot. And it worked out for us.
Yeah. I was going to say, you sort of, in spite of yourselves, you just seemed to go in and say, well, we're going to do it.
Yes. Being naive and not knowing what you can and can't do is such a treasure, you know, when you just start out doing something. It's just like, going, oh, let's just see if this works, you know. And I tell people when they're starting out, there's going to be hundreds of people trying to protect you by telling you, yeah, that's not going to work. And they're doing it from a good place. They don't want you to see you waste your time or get your heart broken because it's really rough to do something. Don't listen to them. They're only defining what can and can't be done by what they themselves can or can't do. And nobody can do what you can do. So go for it. Try it. You know, give it a shot. You'll know when it's not working out. But like a true artist can't be told, no, that's not going to work. You just do it anyway because you can't do anything else. You can't help yourself.
Yeah. Well, Rob Schraub, we are so looking forward to welcoming you back to Milwaukee. Looking forward to your talk at MIAD. Have a safe trip out here.
Thank you so much, Bonnie. This has been lovely, and it's going to be great to be home again.
Emmy-winning and Oscar-nominated writer and director Rob Schraub returns to his home state and his alma mater this week. He's the featured guest for MIAD's Fall Creativity Series event. He gives a free public talk Wednesday evening at the school called Embracing the Dumb, the Rob Schraub Experience. There's more information at WUWM.com. And that's all for Monday's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock. Fresh air is next.